Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Arizona Supreme Court's ruling to take Arizona back 160 years to before it was a state, making an 1864 law criminalizing abortion the law of the land in 2 weeks. Joining us to discuss how Trump and the Republicans are trying to weasel their way out of a situation of their making is Jessica Mason Pietlo, a senior vice president and executive editor at Rewired.news and co-host of the Boom Lawyered podcast. She is a writer and a law professor in Boulder, Colorado, and is the former assistant director of the Health Law Clinic at Hamline Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota. The recipient of the 2018 Excellence in Online Journalism Award, she co-authored Crow After Row, How Women's Health is the New Separate But Equal, and How to Change That. Then, with a left-right coalition of civil libertarians and MAGA Republicans refusing to reauthorize Section 702 of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the latter because Trump thinks it was used to spy on him, we will speak with James Risen, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. His investigative reporting has triggered a series of political firestorms, and among his best-selling books are State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, and Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. The senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times, his new book is The Last Honest Man, The CIA, the FBI, the Mafia, and the Kennedys, and One Senator's Fight to Save Democracy. Then finally, we'll examine the true danger Trump poses from a combination of passivity in the electorate, on the one hand, and the impunity of Trump's anti-democratic criminal clique of kleptocrats on the other, which will be fatal for our democracy. Joining us is Caroline Fredrickson, a visiting professor at Georgetown Law and a strategic counselor on democracy and power at the Open Markets Institute. She served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, as general counsel and legal director of NARAL Pro-Choice America, and during the Clinton administration, as special assistant to the president for legislative affairs. In 2021, she was appointed a member of the President's Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States. The President Emerita of the American Constitutional Society. Her books include The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections. And we will discuss her op-ed at The New York Times, What Worries Me Most About a Trump Presidency. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Jessica Mason Pietlo, who is a senior vice president and executive editor at Rewired.news and the co-host of the Boom Lawyered podcast, and is a writer and adjunct law professor in Boulder, Colorado, and is the former assistant director of the Health Law Clinic in Hamline Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the recipient of the 2018 Excellence in Online Journalism Award. And she co-authored Crow After Row, How Women's Health is the New Separate But Equal, and How to Change That with Robin Marty. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jessica Mason Pietlo.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what do you make of this extraordinary ruling by the Arizona Supreme Court that appears to be backfiring all over the place? It's putting Arizona Republicans like Carrie Lake running for the Senate in danger. And it's also got Trump, who just like a day before this ruling had extolled the virtues of his decision or his call to have the states decide abortion laws and not a national ban. And now he's turning around and saying that the Arizona abortion ruling went too far. And he's saying he's calling on the governor of the state to fix it. Well, the governor happens to be a Democrat. So what the hell is going on here?
I mean, I think that's the Exact right question to ask. First of all, let's set the table a little bit. You know, what the Arizona Supreme Court did this week was resurrect a law dating back to 1864, before Arizona was even a state, and white women could vote and black women were still enslaved, to say that abortions are banned in nearly every circumstance, and that providers who provide them in the wake of that ban can face up to 5 years in prison. And this is both a natural consequence of the Dobbs decision and the return the abortion question to the state's framing. And it is also going to be an increasing risk that we see for conservative judiciaries and signals problems ahead nationally, as well as the Supreme Court potentially resurrects another zombie law in the Comstock Act as a way to restrict or maybe even eventually roll back mifepristone, which is one of two medications currently used in medication abortion in this country. So that's the legal landscape. The political landscape is definitely interesting because on the one hand, Republicans certainly seem to be the dog that caught the car when it comes to abortion here. They have campaigned endlessly, fundraised endlessly, overturning Roe versus Wade as a consistent litmus test. And yet here they are with one of the most unpopular policy proposals enacted in state after state. So these statewide bans are absolutely a result of Donald Trump and the Republican Party moving the Supreme Court in the direction that they did. In terms of what Donald Trump and Carrie Lake may be saying about the result of this, well, I think voters will likely understand that they will say whatever they need to say to try and get elected. There's been no instance where either Lake or Trump has been supportive of abortion rights. And I think ultimately it will be incumbent on voters to pay attention to the record rather than the rhetoric.
Well, Carrie Lake had originally said, we have a great law on the books right now. If that happens, we will be a state where we will not be taking the lives of our unborn anymore. And now, of course, she's completely reversing that. So what's going on, though, with these justices? And they were all appointed by Doug Ducey, the ones that voted. Two voted against it. And the justices, Clint Bullock and Catherine King, are up for election in November, along with the rest of them, including Carrie Lake and others. So the decision by Lopez, the Chief Justice, was pretty aggressive. I mean, he more or less delighted in the possibility of jailing doctors.
Yeah, it was aggressive, with tones to a similarly aggressive decision from a state Supreme Court recently in Florida that voted to uphold a 6-week ban in that state. And what we are seeing is the implementation of a strategy by the conservative legal movement. The conservative legal movement has been moving radically to the right over the last 20 years and is completely and wildly out of step in terms of ideas and values for most of the country. But they also exist in a very insular bubble that doesn't really, from their perspective, need to either interact or respond to the public. And so we have a really precarious situation where judges, in some instances elected, in some instances appointed, in some instances a little hybrid of both, are coming out of intellectual and legal traditions that themselves have been allowed to ferment and percolate without any other check on it. I've been a lawyer for decades now, and this conservative legal movement looks nothing like the conservative legal movement when I was a law student and starting out in legal practice, for example. It is completely out of step with norms, but as a result of a political play to control the courts, they have a significant and outbalanced amount of power.
Well, this is Leonard Leo's dream, isn't it? He's already stacked the Supreme Court with these people who overturned Roe. And the way I see these people, particularly the men, is that it's a moral free ride. They get to be self-righteous about protecting fetuses, but they don't give a damn about the children that are born.
Absolutely. And I think it actually, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot, folks like to point that out because it is an enraging and obvious hypocrisy. And then when you scratch that surface a little bit, what you'll see is it also reflects a very particular social and cultural worldview of how they want this country to operate and where they want this country to be grounded in its morality. And I think it's no coincidence that the conservative justices on the Arizona Supreme Court revived a law from the slave days, much the same way that Justice Sam Alito in the majority opinion in Dobbs looked back as far as the Salem witch trials for a grounding in how we view women and how we view children.
Well, if you give rights to the fetus over the rights to the woman that's carrying it, aren't you making a pretty straightforward statement? Who's more valuable and who has rights and who doesn't? It's just extraordinary.
It really is. And you know, we see this play out in terrible ways. That's exactly what happened in Alabama when its state Supreme Court ruled that the state constitutional amendment called the Human Life Protection Act, which declares life beginning at protection and ostensibly extending rights to a fertilized egg, means that in vitro fertilization, assisted reproductive technologies are banned in the state. And that sent shockwaves across the country. And many congressional Republicans said that that was a bridge too far. And at the same time, were co-sponsors or had signed on to federal legislation that would mirror the Alabama amendment. So we are really in dangerous and uncharted waters here. And let me just, for the listeners, explain what something like giving the rights to a fetus would mean. It's, you know, the IVF example is one of it. But when the state, the government, says that life begins at conception, that means that every positive pregnancy test creates a responsibility to deliver to the state a healthy baby. Otherwise, there is the presumption of criminality. There's the presumption of wrongdoing. So we have created a surveillance state around being pregnant that no person can navigate.
Well, doesn't the Texas law literally have a bounty in that regard?
They do. They do. And that was a law that the Supreme Court allowed to take effect before the Dobbs decision. You know, that the Texas law that bans abortion as of 6 weeks and creates an enforcement mechanism where strangers, you know, citizens who are unhappy about an apparent abortion decision can sue to enforce that ban. And then if they are successful, get paid to the tune of $10,000. So the conservative legal movement has been projecting where they want to take this country, and in particular, where they want to take women and children, for many years now. And the idea of a bounty like that harkens back to the Fugitive Slave Act, right? Like, that's just bonkers.
Well, this is bonkers, though, isn't it? You go back 160 years to an 1864 law before Arizona was a state, when it was a territory during the Civil War. And back then, the age of consent for sex with women was 10.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is unbelievably regressive. That's a polite way of putting it.
Yes, regressive is absolutely a polite way of putting it, I think. And, you know, voters, citizens, folks in this country see through that. Regardless if people have personal discomfort or even opposition to abortion, time and time again, when you ask them, they will say that it should be accessible. But we will hear more about this in just a couple weeks. The Supreme Court is on April 24th set to take up a second abortion case this term. And the question at the heart of that case is whether states can deny women a stabilizing emergency care that includes abortion. So states want, like Idaho, want to be able to deny women abortions, even in emergencies where it would save their life. And the argument that they are making is that, well, actually, we have two patients. We have a developing pregnancy and we have the pregnant person. And abortion will always terminate the life of the developing pregnancy. Therefore, it is never emergency medicine.
So obviously, this is politically a gift to the Democrats, particularly in this incredibly important swing state that Biden won by only 0.3 of 1%. And it's good news for Ruben Gallego, who is running against Carrie Lake. And, of course, the other senator, the one that was in the pocket of corporate America, who was the spoiler of Biden's agenda, Kyrsten Sinema, she's sort of given up. She became an independent and has given up. So I would say that the stars are aligned pretty favorably, are they not, for the Democrats in the state of Arizona?
I mean, one of the lessons from the post-Dobbs or in the post-Dobbs era, I would say, is that when voters have the opportunity to weigh in on abortion rights, it is good for abortion rights, and usually that means it's bad for Republicans. And this is likely going to be the case in Arizona as well. But in the meantime, we still have a worsening human rights crisis where now Arizonans, if they can access care at all, because currently abortion is still legal in Arizona up to 15 weeks, this decision won't take effect for 2 weeks. However, after that, Arizonans are going to look to go to places like California, New Mexico, Colorado, where I am, these surge in protected states that are already buckling under demand as more and more and more restrictive abortion bans take effect across this country.
And of course, the worst one is the Florida one, because women in the Southeast had nowhere to go but Florida. And now that the door is closed on that with the 6 weeks ban. And how long before you'll have these so-called Christian vigilantes at Greyhound bus stops stopping young women, show me your papers, like the Gestapo, to make sure that they have parental consent to leave the state?
We're not far from that. Idaho has enacted a ban that would prevent minors, that attempts to prevent minors from leaving the state to access care, and criminalizes anybody who assists them. Tennessee is debating a similar bill today. That is very likely one of the next frontiers. We're seeing legislation in places like Texas, where local municipalities are creating laws and ordinances that prohibit the use of their roads to travel for abortion care. So the idea of stopping and checking for consent or, you know, checkpoints sounds absolutely like the stuff of, you know, some sort of dystopian novel, but it is very much the world in which the Republican Party is driving us, because we have to always be asking, how do they intend to enforce these things? And it will always require an element of law enforcement, of police power. And we are in a very dark and precarious place right now.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Jessica, what's your understanding, though? I mentioned earlier the sort of moral free ride that these anti-abortion zealots have, where they get to feel self-righteous about somebody else's fetus, but giving that more rights than the woman that's carrying it and not caring about who takes responsibility. So it's righteousness without responsibility. And I can understand why they feel good about it, because again, you can be righteous but without responsibility. But at what point is this movement, you say it's gone too far. Will an electoral rebuke make any difference? You can see that Trump has already figured it out. You know, I mean, I don't know whether you saw his recent television recording he made making his announcements about abortion. It was just stream of consciousness, free-form lies. I mean, he's a natural liar.
Yeah.
There's no distinction between the truth and lies. It's just free-form babbling disinformation, or saying, oh, everybody on both sides is in favor of getting rid of Roe. Well, there's nowhere in the world that that's the case. I mean,
so, you know, this is not a problem that is going to be fixed in one electoral cycle or two electoral cycles or three electoral cycles. And I think to remember, I think one of the most important things to remember is that the Republican Party, through its own actions, through its own words, no matter what their figurehead may be saying in a presidential election cycle right now, has, through the Heritage Foundation and Project 2025, laid out very clearly their policy agenda for the next Republican administration. And it includes using the Comstock Act, which is currently on the books right now, as a way to enact a federal abortion ban. So, and by the way, Trump has been instructed to specifically not mention the Comstock Act or not answer questions around it. So while he is out there just babbling lies and disinformation, he's also being very well handled on the issues to avoid. If Republicans take power in 2024, they intend to weaponize the Department of Justice to resurrect a Victorian era zombie law that says you can't send anything related to abortion through the mail or via common carrier, to shut down abortion clinics, even in states like California, New York, and Colorado, where abortion has been protected and patients are being served. And this is a five-alarm fire that folks need to grapple with. That said, one election in where Democrats win on the federal level won't solve the problem unless they take decided action. The Comstock Act can be repealed. Democrats could do that in a new administration. They can protect the FDA, which is another target. So there are real tangible actions that Democrats could start taking, but they need to understand the veracity of the opposition and the threat that we face right now.
Well, Jessica Mason Picklow, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jessica Mason Picklow, who is a senior vice president and executive editor at Rewire.news and the host of the Boom Lawyered podcast. She's a writer and law professor in Boulder, Colorado, and the former assistant director of the Health Law Clinic at Hamline Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota, and the recipient of the 2018 Excellence in Online Journalism Award. And she has co-authored the book Crow After Roe, How Women's Health is the New Separate But Equal, and How to Change That. We're going to take a brief station break and back, looking into how a left-right coalition of civil libertarians and MAGA Republicans are refusing to reauthorize Section 702 of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Risen, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author whose investigative reporting has triggered a series of political firestorms. Among his best-selling books are State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, and Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. The senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times. His new book is The Last Honest Man, The CIA, The FBI, The Mafia, and The Kennedys, and One Senator's Fight to Save Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Risen.
Thanks for having me.
So the book that I just mentioned is largely about Senator Frank Church, and a sort of centerpiece of his work in many ways. Isn't that up for grabs now, FISA Section 702?
Yeah. One of the things that, you know, the church, Frank Church is best known for chairing the Church Committee, the first ever investigation of the CIA and the intelligence community. And one of the key landmark parts of their investigation was the first ever investigation of the National Security Agency. And they discovered that the NSA had been spying on Americans and their communications. Back then, it was largely phone calls and telegrams. And it was the Church Committee's investigation and disclosures that led to the passage in 1978 of the original FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is still in effect today, but it has been badly amended to weaken it over the years. And one of the ways in which it's been weakened is what's now called the 702 amendment or provision. And it allows for, basically allows for greater spying on Americans than was originally envisioned by when FISA was first enacted. And it's every time that it comes up for reauthorization, because it's never been made a permanent part of FISA, it has to be reauthorized regularly. Every time that it comes up, the intelligence community and the White House, who's ever in the White House at the time, claims that, you know, the terrorists will get us if we don't reauthorize it. And they claim that it is somehow critical to American national security. I don't believe that's ever been true. And when it was first, when this first became a big issue after our reporting at the New York Times about how the Bush administration was skirting FISA in order to spy on Americans, the issue became whether or not the NSA and the government needed probable cause to listen to the international phone calls of American citizens. And at first, when it first came up, Republicans, and especially the Bush administration, argued that it was absolutely necessary and that anybody who opposed it was a traitor and was a terrorist lover. And so that was the default position of the Republican Party for years. And then Donald Trump, who makes everything about himself, became convinced that the government was wiretapping him during the end of the 2016 campaign. And so he became an enemy of an opponent of Section 702, mainly and really only because he thought he was being spied on, which there's no real evidence of. And so the Republican Party, because they are fawning towards Trump, is now convinced that there is a deep state that spies on conservatives, but not on anybody else. And so there's this weird conspiracy theory that has led Republicans to oppose 702 when, in fact, they were the ones who created it under Bush.
And today, so of course, Jim, today, Wednesday morning, Trump posted on his social media platform, "Kill FISA. It was illegally used against me and many others. They spied on my campaign."
Right. Yeah, that's the whole, it's not, he's not right about that, but it's the whole gist of it. Is that somehow he has convinced the Republican Party that there is a deep state out to get conservatives. When anybody who has ever covered the intelligence community can tell you that they are the most conservative people in America. So there is now the strange coalition of right-wing MAGA cult and progressives in Congress who don't like 702 for more valid reasons, which is they don't like any spying on American citizens or any weakening of FISA that would allow that, and the MAGA cult. And so it's one of the few issues in which you see this kind of strange coalition around the opposition to the FISA amendments.
And this coalition is Representative Andy Biggs, Pramila Jayapal, Jerry Nadler, Warren Davidson, Zoe Lofgren, and Jim Jordan. You could not get a more diverse set of bedfellows there.
Yeah. And, you know, the sad thing about the way Congress works and the way American politics works is that we need a real debate about FISA. We need a real debate about domestic spying and about the intelligence community's powers that have been massively increased after 9/11. But to do it based on the idea that it was the intelligence community was mean to Donald Trump is just a bizarre way to try to have a real debate.
But during the Obama administration, the Obama White House came after you, didn't they? Over a story on
NSA. I am opposed to 702. I am opposed to domestic wiretapping. I broke the story about it. All I'm saying is it's weird that Republicans who created 702, who claimed that everybody was a traitor, who opposed it for years, they now claim that it's some liberal conspiracy theory, when in fact it was them. They were the ones who created it. And it's only because Donald Trump thinks that he was wiretapped that they care about it at all. They don't care about how about the spying on other Americans. In fact, if Trump gets in, I'm sure he'll use it to actually spy on American citizens. So I find it very ironic, I guess is the way to put it.
Right. Well, of course, the Speaker Johnson is in the squeeze again because he's getting squeezed over the Ukraine aid as well, with Marjorie Taylor Greene threatening to vacate the speakership. And she doubled down on that yesterday.
Right.
Johnson is trying to wrangle in these closed-door meetings he had today. He said to the press afterwards, "We have to strike a balance, government always does. You have to jealously guard the fundamental liberty of American people, but you have to protect the liberty. But at the same time, you've got to protect our security. And you can't allow a critical tool like this to just expire and go out of use." So this
wow,
is...
Wow, he's sounding more and more like an establishment Republican from the Bush administration era.
Right.
You don't hear much anymore from the Republican MAGA people.
But he does appear
to
be...
Yeah, that was the argument that the Bush administration used, you know, 10, 15 years ago.
Right, He's so far, he's had the kind of history of taking his orders from Trump, has he not? That's the assumption.
Yeah, that's the odd thing. That's what's so surreal about this entire debate, because, you know, I've followed this since it happened. I mean, they passed this law because of my reporting in 2005. And so the reason that this exists at all is because of the Republican Party. And now they want to act, you know, so many of the Trump people want to act like this is somehow a left-wing conspiracy theory foisted on them by Obama and Biden. And that's the part that I find so surreal, is that there's no real sense of reality in the Republican Party anymore.
Right, but the preliminary floor vote on the House rule to expand government surveillance powers, which is favored by the leaderships of both parties, failed to pass in this initial vote this afternoon, and the rule was defeated 228 to 193, with 10 members
not
voting.
Yeah, it's failed in the past. It's failed in some other votes in earlier years on initial votes, and the government usually finds some way to convince holdouts to vote for it. There's a long history, legislative history of this, in which people, a lot of, especially on the right, they will act like they're opposed to it for a vote or two, and then they will, so they can have that on the record, and then they will give in and do what the leadership wants. That's usually, not to sound too cynical, but this is a very cynical process.
And what is
I've seen many times before.
Right. But what is the NSA's argument here? They say that if you required a warrant, then you'd tip off whoever's being surveilled. What is their essential argument?
It's not even that. It's not even that, because there's no warrant required. It's a long and tedious argument that they use, basically saying it would take too much time for us to even determine probable cause. And under the rules that the civil libertarians want, they don't even require going to FISA, the FISA court. What they require is some higher level of oversight of the process. That's really all anybody has been pushing for. And so it becomes this, not to get, it becomes a very arcane debate that a lot of people make sound like it's more of a civil liberties debate than it really is, ultimately, because nobody is pushing for what I think they should push for, which is a demand for warrants and a court order. What they're doing in these cases is they have, not to get too technical, but I've had to deal with this quite a bit for several years, so indulge me here for a minute. The issue boils down to bulk surveillance, where they want to follow a whole string of phone numbers or other metadata, thousands and thousands of them. And they want to do it without any notification of any kind. And that's what the argument comes down to. It's not like we want to listen to one guy and we don't want to get a warrant for it. It's mass surveillance. And that's where I think most of the people in Congress don't even understand what the NSA is talking about. And that's why I think it's so important that it has to be reformed and changed. But the argument they have in Congress about this never really gets to the truth about what's really involved. And that's what's kind of sad.
But just in closing, James Risen, what arguments are the NSA and the national security establishment making that would influence people like the Speaker Johnson
and the
Democrats and all the other leaders? I mean, they're all on the same page.
They'll claim if you don't do this, ISIS will blow up New York, or that we'll have terrorist attacks tomorrow. And usually for the first several years, it was like clockwork that every time this came up for reauthorization, there would be some terrorist threat announced.
But that just happened with the director of the FBI.
I'm sure it was tied into. That's what they always do. And so the real issue is not that they want to target Donald Trump, which is the Republican thing, or the Democratic position, really, which is that, they want to target some individual. It's much worse than either side is talking about. It's mass surveillance of American communications on a huge scale that nobody in Congress ever talks about. And so the whole system requires reform. And nobody in Congress is really talking about that.
But just in closing, Johnson's gambit today failed, in spite of him including two unrelated amendments, which would be hard to vote against. One denounced the Biden administration's immigration policy, and the other condemned efforts to impose one-sided pressure on Israel with respect to Gaza. So who knows what they're trying to do here? I mean, they're all about grandstanding.
That's kind of the way, that's the way it usually gets passed, is some, not through that, but in previous years, they'll have, they'll tie it into some funding for some program that everybody agrees has to be funded, like the Pentagon. A lot of times they'll tie it into the defense authorization bill or something like that. And then they will announce, they'll have some secret briefing that will mysteriously get leaked, saying, you know, if there's a ISIS is threatening America again. So it's a very cynical process. And the cynicism is only, you know, a whole new layer of cynicism has come from the Republicans claiming that this is all about spying on Donald Trump. And Trump, everybody knows that's a lie, but they keep, but that's the one thing that has gotten Republicans to move from supporting 702 to opposing it.
Well, James Risen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure, sure. It's a very complicated, cynical issue.
Well, you are the right guy to talk to since you were in the crosshairs. And again, I've been speaking with James Risen, a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author whose investigative reporting has triggered a series of political firestorms. Among his best-selling books are State of War, The Secret History of the CIA and the Bush Administration, and Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. The senior national security correspondent at The Intercept and a former investigative journalist with The New York Times. His new book is The Last Honest Man, The CIA, The FBI, The Mafia, and The Kennedys, and One Senator's Fight to Save Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the true danger Trump poses from a combination of passivity in the electorate on the one hand and the impunity of Trump's anti-democratic criminal clique of kleptocrats on the other, which will be fatal for our democracy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Caroline Fredrickson, a visiting professor at Georgetown Law and a strategic counselor on democracy and power at the Open Markets Institute. She served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, as general counsel and legal director of NARAL Pro-Choice America, and during the Clinton administration as special assistant to the president for legislative affairs. In 2021, she was appointed a member of the president's commission on the Supreme Court of the United States, and she's the President Emerita of the American Constitution Society, and her books include The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections, and she has an op-ed at the New York Times, What Worries Me Most About a Trump Presidency. Welcome to Background Briefing, Caroline Fredrickson.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Caroline, and your article at the New York Times suggested the threat that Trump poses is a combination of a kind of demoralized electorate on the one hand, or an indifferent and demoralized electorate on the one hand, and Trump's kleptocratic criminal clique on the other. And the portent is frightening, and it should be very clear to everybody what's happening and what he represents. And that's what I don't understand, is how much he's breaking the law already and has broken the law already with the Emoluments Clause, which he's absolutely, you know, just trashed it. Routinely, he threatens judges, court officials, judges' families, juries. And now there's a new study coming out of UCLA indicating that poll workers in this country, the normally neutral people that do volunteer work largely to manage the polls and the elections in this country, they're quitting in droves because of intimidation. And the intimidation is coming from Trump. So he's already behaving like a mafia boss. So why is it that he hasn't been pulled over? Why is it that that he gets away with stuff that normal people would be in jail for?
Well, I mean, it's a great question, and it's sort of the obvious question, right? That Trump has gotten away with so much. I think, I think he's basically acted on something that has always been a problem, right? That the powerful and the rich have always had a much easier time in getting away with the things that the rest of us could never get away with. And I think Trump has just recognized that and taken it to an extreme. So he doesn't just do it in the odd case. He does it all the time. I mean, the more he gets away with things, the more he gets away with things. It's sort of the too big to fail for criminality, right? Too big to go to jail. And much of what he does, you know, is on the border of illegality. It's more, violations of norms and habits and attitudes than it's necessarily always a pure illegal act. And I think that is where, I see a real problem. I mean, I see lots of real problems with another Trump presidency. Don't get me wrong. But I think one of the kind of underappreciated aspects is the fact of the intimidation that happens on the inside, that when he can add to his to the politicized civil service that he plans to have, that is to have his political appointments sweep much more broadly, the kind of intimidation that's going to happen to the rest of the civil service, where we are dependent on certain kinds of protections that allow them to be whistleblowers or have civil service protections that allow them to respond to instructions or directions that they think are illegal or in conflict with prevailing law. And that is all going to be more and more difficult as we have more and more people, basically filling themselves at the trough of government, in Trump's wake.
Well, another thing that puzzles me, and it's in the same area of my confusion here, and that is that I don't understand why the average American can't notice the fact that Trump's tactic of delaying these many court cases against him and the 91 indictments is obsessive. And so aggressive and reaching the point of absurdity, where he's coming up with all kinds of ridiculous ideas that the courts have to strike down. But nevertheless, he's delaying stuff. And an innocent man, particularly in an election year, would want to clear his name and get these cases, court cases, over as quickly as possible to make clear that he's innocent. This guy does the opposite. So doesn't
that's
that
right.
imply guilt? And I just forget for the life of me, I don't understand why that's not obvious.
We should remember how he operated in his first campaign, right? It's all been a big from the beginning. And the first time around, I think he was kind of surprised that he won. He really did it as a way to delay, sort of the creditors coming after him, to put money in his own pockets by, having an easier way of promoting his own products. I mean, the crap that guy tries to sell, from Trump wines and ties and now, the whole set of crazy things from the high top sneakers to, of all things, a Bible. It's always been a money-making scheme for him. He knows that the bigger profile he has, the more his MAGA masses are going to buy his crap. And now, he sort of recognized that in the second go round, that, to the extent that he has actually stepped over the line, which, he obviously has many times in his life, but finally prosecutors are coming after him. The best way to prevent, anything from happening is to win the presidency and clean house and get rid of all those prosecutors. And so, got to delay those prosecutions till after the election in order to make sure that happens.
Well, you're also describing Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister, who is keeping a war going in order to stay out of jail. And there's no question that he wants Trump to come back, as is Vladimir Putin, Mohammed bin Salman. Those two together can control the price of oil, and they can jack up the price of gasoline at the pump in the fall, just ahead of the elections. They've done it before. They both gave Trump a favor by lowering the price of gas, and back in 2022 they raised the price of gas to hurt Biden. So, and the Saudis happen to own the biggest oil refinery in the country in Port Arthur, Texas. About 60% of the gasoline comes out of there. And that should never have happened, but Trump let it happen, even though it's critical infrastructure, according to Homeland Security. So this is what worries me, Caroline, is that these malign foreign powers, particularly despots like Putin and Mohammed bin Salman, and even Xi Jinping, they hate democracy. They work to undermine democracy. They're clear about it. It's an anathema to them. So Trump seems to share that belief. He has no regard for democracy. It's all about him and his power and gratification. So again, that should be pretty clear that you've got these people out there that are on the same page as Trump because they hate democracy. He's transactional and corrupt. He'll do whatever they want. Then they're already bribing him in any case, and certainly bribing his son-in-law, aren't they?
Oh, no question. I mean, this is a model that has been successful for any number of other autocratic leaders who now see Trump as, you know, part of their circle. You know, I think there's a lot of analogies here, though, to the way that Putin has operated in creating a kind of a feudal oligarchic kleptocracy. That is, you know, he's created all of these highly dependent oligarchs who know that, you know, they can't question what Putin does, because if they do, well, I mean, he might defenestrate them. You know, the word that you wouldn't think would have come back into usage so much until the Russian leader has decided that people who oppose him, the best way to get rid of them is to push them out of windows or to, you know, dust them with some kind of plutonium, you know, or otherwise. But basically, if you get out of line, you know, you're going to lose everything you have at the best, and at the worst, you know, he's going to kill you off, and that creates real dependencies. And you know, I think Trump's model is at this point less perhaps violent and dangerous, but it certainly has the same markings of creating that kind of dependency, a kind of a feudal state where you give away the benefits of the state, and you know, but there's a cost, right? The cost of loyalty.
Well, in Trump's case, his oligarchs, the American plutocracy, at least the right-wing plutocracy, there, many of them were down in Mar-a-Lago just recently supporting him. Many of them, by the way, were appalled by what happened on January the 6th and cut bait with him. But now they're back on board because he is going to lower their taxes even further after the Trump tax cuts, which incidentally expire next year. And they don't want Biden in the White House because he won't renew Trump's tax cuts. So at the end of the day, Americans' oligarchs care more about not paying taxes. And by the way, the surplus money that they have by not paying taxes, like Jeff Yass, who's the biggest donor to the Republicans and is obsessively anti-tax, the surplus money he gets from not paying taxes, he invests in politics to lower his taxes even further. I mean, that's what these guys are up to. So is there a chance of pulling them over in terms of their lack of patriotism?
Well, I think it's a very good argument. I think that was just made about Jamie Dimon, you know, in his suggesting that, you know, the tax cuts are maybe more important than anything else. Well, yeah, how about our democracy? How about that? Isn't that really what we should be fighting for? I think it's past time that people stop thinking Wall Street was somehow a force for good. The hedge fund managers, the bankers, and those other corporate leaders, I mean, perhaps not all of them, but certainly a good number of them, you know, are really on board for, you know, protecting their wealth at the cost of our democracy. And we have to push back on that.
So I guess what we're sort of circling around here today, Caroline, is a kind of a real populist revolt, not the phony populism that Trump has captured. The billionaire who's got all of these angry white working class people supporting him, as though they're going to win the lottery, when in fact he doesn't give a damn about them and in fact has contempt for them. What are the chances of a the issues that we're talking about becoming front and center? Because my understanding is that with the polls, most Americans are not happy about billionaires not paying their taxes.
Yeah, well, we need to talk more about it. I think it's not been enough part of the overall dialogue. I think between billionaires not paying their taxes and basically forcing the rest of us to carry the load, and you know, the courts decimating personal autonomy and women's right to control their bodies, I think we got some, there's some powerful issues for November, and we need to get out there and talk about them. You know, there's a, it's just, this is stark. The differences are stark in all the metrics that you can imagine. So, you know, I think we have to understand that there is this continuum of the drive to line the pockets of the plutocrats leads to ever worse outcomes on social justice matters. And as you just said, and as I something I wrote about in a piece I wrote for The Atlantic in September, the richer that the plutocrats get, the more money they put in the politics, the more likely it is that, you know, more state Supreme Courts are going to take away women's right to an abortion and restrict LGBTQ people's rights to their own personal autonomy. And, you know, there are other things that are in the crosshairs. I mean, gay marriage is certainly something that, you know, Clarence Thomas has raised as something he'd like to undo. So, you know, we have to understand that these are not separate issues. Plutocracy and freedom for us are important and connected, and our freedom is going to be lost if the plutocrats own our government.
So just in closing, though, Liz Cheney warned that we're sleepwalking into dictatorship. And at the end of the day, there is, I guess, a silent majority. I mean, we're facing the tyranny of the minority, and there's nothing more stark than the handful in the House, the pro-Putin caucus, just five, you know, 8-9 people holding up funds for Ukraine and basically blackmailing the new speaker. That's the situation we have. So there's no question we have a tyranny of the minority, but we also have the sleeping giant, right? The silent majority going back to Nixon's day. So at the end of the day, is it all about arousing the silent majority?
Well, I mean, it is about making sure people understand the stakes and that Trump doesn't speak for the vast majority of American people. That he speaks for, really, for the plutocrats. He speaks for the oligarchs. He speaks for his own personal self-interest more than anything else. And people have got to recognize that this guy, he's about, you know, ripping us off so that he can be even richer than he is. And he thinks that, you know, being president is the best way to do it. So grifter in chief, that's what he wants to be.
Well, it's almost like he could take lessons from his own son-in-law, right? I mean, I'm not sure who I despise more, Trump or Jared Kushner.
Well, I mean, you don't have to choose. So, but I think, you know, one of the reasons Jared is acting with so much impunity is he thinks, you know, his father-in-law is going to become president, and then whatever he does, he'll get pardoned.
Right. And the reason that MBS and others are throwing money at him is because of that very reason, right?
Exactly.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Caroline Fredrickson. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Ian. So much appreciate being on your show, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Caroline Fredrickson, who's a visiting professor at Georgetown Law and a strategic counselor on democracy and power at the Open Markets Institute. She served as the director of the ACLU's Washington Legislative Office, as general counsel and legal director of NAREL Pro-Choice America, and during the Clinton administration was special assistant to the president for legislative affairs. In 2021, she was appointed a member of the President's Commission on the Supreme Court of the United States and is the president emerita of the American Constitutional Society, and her books include The Democracy Fix, How to Win the Fight for Fair Rules, Fair Courts, and Fair Elections. And she has an op-ed at the New York Times, What Worries Me Most About a Trump Presidency. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org. where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media, and please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305.